The Guardian.
During April, The Guardian's podcasts are partnering with audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/audible to find out more.
This is Politics Weekly, I'm Tom Clark. Coming up, sleaze and the slump. Media moguls turn hunt saboteurs and the economy double dips into a recession as a bad month gets an awful lot worse for the government. Can David Cameron staunch the flow of credibility from his embattled coalition before next week's elections? Also this week, Nicolas Sarkozy is on the ropes in France as socialist candidate François Hollande tops the poll in the first round of presidential voting. But who can attract the far-right voters who now hold the balance of power? We'll be hearing from our Paris correspondent Angelique Grisafis later on. But joining me now in the studio, we have The Guardian columnists Polly Toynbee and Seamus Milne, while down the line from right outside the Leveson Inquiry, we have our very own Michael White. A warm welcome to you all. Now, first of all, Michael White, you're down there outside the Royal Courts of Justice. You've been listening to none other than the great mogul Rupert Murdoch himself this morning, giving another several hours of evidence. What have we heard so far?
Well, it's the second day of Rupert Murdoch's testimony, and he had an altogether less satisfactory day than he did yesterday. By the time he'd finished, after about 3 hours in the box, there was a rare cross-examination by our own trade union, the NUJ. Gosh, the lads must have loved that. But he didn't shed much light on that. But he was rambling by the time he'd finished. He made a statement about the internet and the BBC. Probably sensible things he was trying to say, but it obviously given them little or no thought. And, you know, he's 81, and it was showing. And earlier than that, he'd been given quite a rough time at various points by Robert Jay, the leading lawyer, and interestingly enough, made a very personal attack upon Paul Dacre, his rival, editor at the Daily Mail, and been required to withdraw what he'd said by the lawyers representing Associated Newspapers, which run the Daily Mail. Lots of other points, but no, not a good morning for Mr. Murdoch. He looked like a tired old gent who didn't know much and didn't think very deeply about what he did know.
Now, it was not so long ago that the Culture Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, was being spoken of as a future leader of the Conservative Party. A potential prime minister, perhaps. Well, not by Michael White, but some around Mr. Hunt may have been making that suggestion. Suddenly, however, this week he's fighting for his cabinet job as allegations of improper conduct surround his department. It's a terrible week for the government. Jeremy Hunt has accepted the resignation of his special advisor, the gloriously named Adam Smith, who was in close contact with a Murdoch lobbyist during the bidding process of B Sky B, where Mr. Hunt was meant to be acting as a judge. This week in Parliament, Jeremy Hunt vowed to set the record straight about his own behaviour.
Transcripts of conversations and texts published yesterday between my special adviser Adam Smith and a News Corporation representative have been alleged to indicate there was a back channel through which News Corporation were able to influence my decisions. This is categorically not the case.
Now, Mike, you're usually more cautious than many others when penning political obituaries in advance. Is Jeremy Hunt finished?
Not clear yet. The emails were sent by the wonderful Adam Smith. Thank God Keynes wasn't on the case. And by the chap Frederick Michel, about whom Mr. Murdoch, incidentally, was quite kind in testimony this morning, must be good at his job. But guys in their position, one as a lobbyist for Murdoch and the other as a special advisor to a cabinet minister, are sometimes, if they're young and hungry and ambitious, prone to exaggerate what they've got. Maybe journalists do this a bit as well. So it's quite possible that Hunt, at the end of this day, will be able to say, well, look, Michel was exaggerating. using his intelligence, Adam Smith wasn't telling him as half as much as he, Michelle was boasting that he was, and I didn't know anything about it anyway. It's not a full defense, because this man, Smith, is there as a special advisor. He's the eyes and ears in a political sense of the Secretary of State in any department. That's why these guys have existed these last 30 years or so under both governments. They're there as the political backstop, and Hunt should have known that he might be able to wriggle free. On these occasions, it sometimes depends how much other MPs like or respect or dislike or disdain you in your own party and beyond. You can fall on the public opinion of the Westminster Village, you might say.
Seamus, what do you think? Is he finished?
Well, I think Mike's right. It's obviously too early to say, because there's, I mean, if more came out which was more damning about him, then obviously he'd have to go. There's a big price for the government, I think, in keeping him. And while this carries on, he'll be the target for continual political attack. And of course, this whole saga plays into a much broader political narrative about this government and about the political class as a whole, the corruption that's, you know, been shown to be far deeper in British public life than I think many people thought, that covers the police, the media, the bankers, parts of the civil service, the revolving door culture. And I think that does, in the kind of climate we're in, it plays, of course, to the whole, against the whole political class, but it's very damaging to the government. And so I think this is, as this carries on, it'll be drawing blood all the time.
Polly, I mean, the lesson of special advisers who've been sacked in the past, one thinks of Stephen Byers, whatever, is if you hang on to them for too long as a minister, you're then in the firing line yourself. But do you think Hunt's got rid of his man quickly enough?
I think he got rid of him pretty sharpish. I think that Hunt is in a lot of trouble, and his only hope is that if things get worse, Cameron will cling even tighter to him, because the finger is pointing so directly to number 10. We've already had today that Cameron announced he'd had two official meetings with Murdoch since he'd come into number 10, and in fact he's had seven. He didn't count the others because they were social, despite the fact that we know that social involved a lot of business conversation as well. We do know things that we didn't necessarily focus on before about Jeremy Hunt, that he took this five-day trip to the United States to talk to News Corp, to talk to the Murdoch empire. And 6 days later, James Murdoch went into, at a time when they were deciding whether or not to bid for the whole of Sky, 6 days later, James Murdoch walks into number 10 and discusses that bid that he's going to make for Sky. Now, that is extraordinary and very damning. We do know that Hunt refused to refer this to the Competition Commission, despite Ofcom having advised it. We knew this before, but the details of all of this now present a picture. It's like putting a jigsaw together that is really damning. And it's not just of Hunt. Of course, it's of the whole government. Of course, he was acting on behalf of those in number 10 as well. There's just no doubt about it.
I mean, this is the real, the centrepiece of Hunt's defence in Parliament yesterday was very much, I made four decisions at every stage about the Competition Commission, Ofcom and whatever else. And at every stage, I went against News Corporation and what they wanted. And I just couldn't quite figure that with my memory of how the thing had played out before Millie Dowler and even after the Millie Dowler story broke.
No, it makes no sense whatever. I mean, he was advised by Ofcom to send it to the Competition Commission. He didn't. A Competition Commission couldn't possibly have allowed this to go through. When you look at the monopoly it would have gifted him with bundling up all of his media interests, it would have been toxic, and he wouldn't have got it through the Competition Commission.
And of course, Mike, in the end, it was News Corporation that backed off, wasn't it, rather than any decision by Jeremy Hunt or anyone else?
Well, they realised they were on a loser here. I always like to talk against the run of play, and there is always a danger of investing too much significance in dates and details and who went where and what. And I say that because Murdoch had plainly, in court today, had plainly never heard of Jeremy Hunt. He was in New York, was he? I didn't know. I didn't see him. He met News Corp executives. Did he? I didn't know. He declared himself to be a cheerleader, Mr. Murdoch, for your enterprises on his website. Did he? I didn't know. Why should I know? Well, you should know, Mr. Murdoch, because it's very important, his attitude towards you getting this bid. And Murdoch said several times, I didn't see the fuss about this bid. We control the company with 40%. This is Sky B. It was a commonplace, was the word he used, transaction where you bid for the shares you you don't, the outstanding shares you don't already own. No big deal, he said. It happens all the time. I wish I'd never floated the company in public, he added. One of my mistakes. And the extent to which he was, he said it was a pretty big deal, but a pretty routine one. He was sort of unimpressed by this. It wasn't all Mr. Murdoch trying to con us. You know, he really isn't bothered with this sort of detail. Perhaps he should be. Certainly his minions should be, and certainly some of them have misbehaved. But lobbying happens under all governments, and it's not only the commercial people who lobby. Trade unions lobby. And why shouldn't they? Charities lobby. I'm sure Oxfam does its best to change legislation too. As long as we can see what's going on, that's okay.
Seamus, do you think in the run-up to the local elections that we've got coming up, people will look at this and think, oh, Kesara has always been lobbying, everyone lobbies? Or do you think people might sort of identify it more precisely with the Conservative Party?
I think a bit of both. I mean, it's clearly, you know, this has been going on for some time. This saga has been running for quite a long time. As Mike was saying, a lot of the detail gets lost, and it's very much of course, a media story, and that's so the media is very focused on it. Whether that has the same play in the rest of the country is another thing. But in the context of everything else, you know, the series of own goals and incompetences, and the fact that we've now got this confirmation of a full-blown second recession, and people are feeling the pinch of the benefit cuts that have come into play this month, falling living standards, job losses. You know, it's clear that in the run of it, the local elections will play against the government, whatever might happen in London or in Scotland or in particular places, and this will feed into it. I mean, I must say, I don't agree with Mike that you can compare lobbying by large corporations with commercial interests at the heart of government with trade union lobbying for the rights of people at work. I just don't think that's a comparable thing at all. And of course, the trade union lobbying is a very open and straightforward thing. And what we're talking about here is the nexus of connections between corporate power and politics, which is at the heart of the corruption I was talking about earlier. And I mean, I also don't think that what Rupert Murdoch says can really be taken at face value on almost anything of this. I mean, we've seen, you know, very clearly spelt out by Harold Evans in The Guardian today how Rupert Murdoch lied about the secret meetings he had with Margaret Thatcher when she was Prime Minister at the time he took over Times newspapers. So I really do think that a very large bucket of salt should be taken with this evidence.
Polly?
Absolutely. I think Harry's got his axe to grind too. He's a wonderful journalist and a great man, but he was axe grinding in the paper today. That's okay.
Mike, the other thing that's really important is there is something different about media monopoly, because media monopoly controls politicians. It's far more dangerous. I mean, it's not good to have monopolies in any industry. This has proved itself since Margaret Thatcher first gifted him extraordinary power. What this would have given him would have been pretty much the demolishing of most other newspapers as he bundled together absolutely everything. His Sky operation is now so profitable and soaring ahead. The packages he would have offered, buying up absolutely everything that was worth having in terms of television talent and all of that, as well as newspapers, putting them together. That is
Polly,
how he manages to get a grip on the politicians. Somebody who runs the electricity companies, who are something of a cartel, doesn't have the same grip on politics and the same influence.
Yeah, the grip on prices, but Polly's basically right.
Whether we freeze or not, you would be astonished the amount which Murdoch has talked about plurality in the media and diversity and the importance of it to our democracy.
Well,
all the time. No, it's not entirely guff, because he looks at the BBC. He only had a couple of minutes on this today. It's just a different way of looking at the world, and says, you know, the BBC is destroying local journalism by helping to put local newspapers out of work. Now, you and I could argue about that for 25 minutes, but the fact is, it's not entirely one-sided. He's not a total villain. One of the odd things about this man is he is a newspaper romantic. His son would shut down or sell his British newspapers tomorrow, then we'd all be in trouble. Talk about plurality and diversity. And the shareholders, he said, they want me to sell all my British newspapers, but I love newspapers. He loves the son. And that bit wasn't bullshit, frankly. You could tell that the old rogue meant it.
But it's partly bullshit, because he knows how powerful those newspapers are to get what he wants from his other end. What he keeps denying, which just makes obviously jaw drop, when he keeps saying, I have never used my newspapers for my commercial interest, leaf through the Sunday Times every week forever. So he doesn't altogether tell the truth, Mike. It may come as a shock to you.
There was a lovely moment when he said, well, you know, the idea that Mr. Justice Eadie had said that in Max Mosley's case, he didn't bother to read Max Mosley's letter, said, well, the hacks threatened somebody with blackmail, and what they'd done was say, you know, we'll keep your picture out of the paper if you cooperate with us. And Murdoch said, well, you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours, and that's the way the world works. And Jay, the barrister, said, it's funny, Mr. Murdoch, that you don't apply that principle in your dealings, so you tell us, with the politicians. Very good point. Murdoch didn't have an answer to that one.
Well, as Murdoch called it, the game. He called this whole relationship a game.
Well, some people use that language.
They do.
You know, it increasingly looks like there are people who, you know, you're saying he's not a total villain, and of course lots remains to be seen in this in this saga as it unfolds. There are some people who look more precarious on that count than others, and of course there's the case of Rebecca Brooks and Andy Coulson, who are likely to be in the spotlight in the months ahead. And I wonder, does that, Mike, do you think threaten to cast a shadow of sleaze over the government for a long time to come? Because of their connections with Cameron?
I think there's a wider question of competence here. If I think Polly or Seamus said, you know, not all voters are as concerned about this as we are. It's our own industry. You're damn right about that. We've just slipped back into a recession. That worries people a great deal more, and rightly so. It becomes, so the media angle and the sleaze stuff, remember John Major sleaze, becomes part of a sort of wider narrative of, are they competent? Are they reasonably straight? Are we all in this together? Were they entitled to cut the top rate of tax in last month's budget because they really think it'll help the economy, or are they just doing it for their mates? And that's very much in the balance. It's been an awful month for the government, but you know, in our trade, we tend to build up. Every month is the worst month, and over the long haul, it's about the recovery of the economy, which this government will be judged on by voters, and you've got to hang on to that. Terrible time at the moment.
Major minor is a phrase that's been doing the rounds on the Labour side this week, meaning that Cameron is now looking like John Major Minor. I'm not sure he is quite there yet, Seamus, is he? He's considerably more popular than John Major was at his lowest point.
Well, of course, John Major was popular and was re-elected in 1992 during a recession, or the very early stages of recovery from recession. So John Major had his ups and downs as well. I mean, I don't think it's the kind of situation in the latter days of the Major government at all. We're not in that at all. But I think the fundamentals for this government are very bad. And, you know, fundamentally, as Mike was talking about, the economy and how that affects people's daily lives and their living standards and their core interests is at the heart of the Cameron problem, and the incompetence factor and the omni-shambles of the last month has just been a trigger for those underlying living standards issues, I think, to come out. I mean, it's not a coincidence that it's happened the same month when so many of these attacks on people's basic take-home pay have come into effect through the benefit cuts and tax credit cuts and so on.
Polly, do you think on the economy now, there might be a danger in getting too hung up on these particular statistics? It's national income, it's gone just down by 0.2%. Clearly very bad news. Maybe doesn't tell us anything about where things will be in a year's time. The employment figures this time were a bit better than a lot of people had been expecting.
Well, the employment figures weren't really. They were a bit massaged because they said, oh, isn't it wonderful, there's 35,000 more jobs. Actually, there were 27,000 fewer full-time jobs. All of the extra were part-time, and they are all people, and they were all men, desperate for more hours and for more jobs. So it wasn't quite as rosy as it looked at first. They're very good at blurring the difference between part and full-time. And now, of course, the benefit system will no longer top up people on part-time pay if you're not working 24 hours. It's catastrophic for a lot of families who can only get part-time work. So I think that you're right, of course. The we've only just tipped back into recession. It's a kind of big headline for a tiny tenth of a point. But globally, that has quite a big impact. You know, these markets that we're in hock to, the headline is Britain back into recession. It's pretty bad news.
Seamus, now I'm just going to ask you to make a quick punt on the coming local elections. You foreseeing mixed fortunes, are you, for Labour in some parts of the country and then in London?
Well, it's just the fact that obviously Labour has a very substantial lead nationally at the moment. In some polls, it's up to 12%, and in London, it's in one poll, it was 19% over the Tories. But because of personality factors in London, the Boris and Ken issue, and how that's played out through the media, that's not reflected in the polls in London. So it's possible that Boris Johnson could win the election in London, despite the fact that he's a right-wing conservative politician who's been given a licence to be a little bit more independent in public. In Scotland, obviously, you've got the national question, the SNP, so it's possible the SNP could take control of Glasgow City Council, and you've also got new voting arrangements. So you've got these exceptions, but, I mean, nationally, you'd expect Labour to do well in the local elections.
Well, I think on the projections, kind of overall projections that Labour, that Seamus just mentioned, a couple of hundred Labour gains, possibly more, building on last year. But I think the more interesting dimension, this disaffection of voters from conventional politics, is what you could call England, something more familiar in Scotland and Wales, is the sort of fourth party politics idea of it, that in rejecting Labour and the Tories, and of course the Lib Dems are in the doldrums with many people for having joined the coalition, then you're looking at other parties, protest votes, stay at homes, independents, Ken Livingstone and Boris Johnson, in a way are quasi independents in a funny way. I don't agree with Seamus that Boris is given licence. They wouldn't dare. But Boris plays it his own way. He's an ambitious man. And then there's respect, and there's the Greens, and on the right there's UKIP and the BNP. And as Seamus said, in Scotland there's the Nats who want to take Glasgow from Labour. Of course, Alex Salmond took a hit from the Murdoch family in the High Court here this week, when he was seen as a Jeremy Hunt-type gopher for Murdoch's interest, B Sky B, employs a lot of people in Scotland. So, you know, it'll be an interesting night. And as always, turn out maybe the determinant, a bit depressing if it's low, but that's real life. And I think Boris will win in London. I just wish Ken Livingstone had persuaded himself not to stand again. It just feels wrong.
Polly, why is it you think that in spite of the widespread mistrust in the Tory government at the moment, it's not turning into Red Ken versus Blue Boris in London? There's a poll out today saying that Boris has got an 8-point lead.
Yep, Boris is doing very well. He's charming, he's funny. People who don't like politics like people who don't look like other politicians, and Boris doesn't, and that's his talent. You know, ruffled and rumpled and full of sort of extraordinary verbal fireworks of one kind or another. He's quite charming. And so people think, well, that's just Boris. And of course, it's not just Boris. I mean, just Boris was busy lobbying to have the top rate of tax cut, which he succeeded in getting for his friends in the city. But nevertheless, when people are sick of politics, they probably will look for those who look least like conventional candidates.
Well, let's leave that there and move over to another part of the world where people are struggling with economic stagnation. Across the water in Paris, the incumbent president, Nicolas Sarkozy, is dealing with some unpopularity of his own. Socialist candidate François Hollande pipped him in the race for the French presidency in the first round of voting. But as we move into the decisive second and final runoff of voting next Sunday, it's a couple of million people who turned up to support the far-right National Front that looks set to decide the election. Now, Angélique Chrysaphis in Paris, how has France got into this extraordinary position where it's these real right-wingers who hold the balance of power? Wouldn't it be like UKIP and the BNP having the casting votes here in Britain?
Yeah, it's a very strange feeling here at the moment. What really happened on Sunday night was the first round of the presidential vote. So there were 10 candidates, two obviously went through. The real breakthrough, in a sense, was for François Hollande, who's the socialist candidate. He came first. He topped the ballot. He was about 2 points clear of Nicolas Sarkozy. This is very bad news for Sarkozy in one sense, because it's the first time a serving president running for re-election has been in second place in the first round vote. So it's not a good position for Sarkozy at all. Now, what happened with Le Pen, which was one kind of shock of the evening, was the sense that she came in with a very strong showing, 17.9%. She came in third position. She did very well all over France, particularly in rural areas, not just her normal stronghold areas. And what this means is her voters on the far right are now the kingmakers. So what it means is both Hollande and Sarkozy have got to chase those voters to win. in France, the election always comes down to the left bloc, as it were, and the right bloc. And now, on paper, the left bloc has 43%. That's Hollande and various other left-wing candidates coming in. And then Sarkozy, if you add him up with Le Pen, he's got 48%. So you might say, oh, it's all in the bag for Sarkozy. But, of course, the far-right Le Pen voters are a very anti-Sarkozy vote, and they're not going to necessarily line up behind him. So we've got this terribly strange atmosphere here where Sarkozy's pushing even further to the right, bashing immigrants and so on, in order to try and win that vote. And it's made the final results a little less predictable than we thought.
But presumably he risks alienating some centrist voters, maybe even some people who backed him on the first round, by adopting that tack.
Yes, he does. And he's also risking sort of implosion of his own party, which is in a very kind of fragile state at this moment anyway, wondering what will happen if Sarkozy were to lose. The polls at the moment are putting François Hollande ahead of Sarkozy by about 10 points in the second round runoff. Sarkozy, to win, needs to take a lot of Le Pen voters. He would need about 70 to 80% of Le Pen voters to come behind him. And pollsters are saying that Le Pen voters broadly, about 50% might transfer to Sarkozy. Some would go to Hollande and some would abstain. So it's the great unknown. But Sarkozy is not holding back. He's really throwing everything into this right-wing campaign, which, of course, he's been running from the very start.
But how is it, if we take a step back, that France got into this position whereby, you know, the king-making bloc is the far right?
Well, this is the strange nature of the French election being this sort of two-candidate runoff. Last time round in 2007, of course, Sarkozy, you know, his big boast and what he said would be his great legacy to France was that he pretty much eradicated the Front National and Jean-Marie Le Pen, who ran then. They were down at about 10%. They were completely cash-strapped. They had to sell their party headquarters, and they're really down in the doldrums. The problem with Sarkozy for him now is that he ran a very right-wing campaign, almost, you know, sharing the same views as Marine Le Pen on many things like immigration, and still they're up really strong. So it's left this sort of taste in the mouth in France that even for François Hollande and the socialists, that there's such a feeling against the political class, there's such a feeling of abandonment among a lot of French people, to do with immigration but also to do with the euro crisis and national identity, that this is that what we're looking at now is a real sense of a kind of a fractured society full of malaise. And we've said that before about France, of course, in terms of the extreme right. But it's even more clear now when we've had a president like Sarkozy running on the furthest right ticket we've ever seen, really, in the French election race. So it's not just Le Pen on the far right, it's Sarkozy as well who's been on her ground. So it's really changed the whole flavour of the discourse in politics in France.
So if you had to try and sum up where that far right vote had come from, would you say it was more to do with immigration or unemployment or just a sort of sense that France isn't a leader in Europe like it used to be?
It's a real mix. And Marine Le Pen, of course, would argue people are voting for me because they adhere to my ideas and my manifesto, which, of course, includes taking France out of the euro and back to the franc. It's very mixed. I've spoken to a broad range of people, from sort of very posh philosophy students in Paris who vote Front National to much poorer people in the sort of Rust Belt in the north of France. One of the interesting things is that Marine Le Pen has done very well in lots of tiny, very kind of nice rural villages in France where, you know, no immigrants live at all. And the feeling there is because people are very angry about post offices closing and the whole rural identity of France going. Alongside the immigration issue, crime, security, and one of the big factors that a young voter who works for a record company told me was that they want this idea of a priority or a preference for French, a national preference whereby French people get preference in jobs and housing over others. But there is also this idea of anti-Sarkozyism, of how Sarkozy has turned off the voters, turned them against him because of promises he didn't keep and because of his whole style of governing, particularly the people that went towards him because of these right-wing values and felt that he betrayed them. So it's a real mix.
Seamus?
Well, I think it's a mistake to see the National Front in France as UKIP plus BNP in Britain equivalent. I mean, firstly, it's been a big, powerful force in French politics for much longer, and it's got a big appeal to working class voters who previously voted left, especially for the Communist Party, who feel excluded from, you know, economic development and in deindustrialized parts of France. And so I think the the scale of that vote, which was, okay, it was in for a first round, it was just ahead of the previous record for the National Front. But of course, her dad, Marine Le Pen's dad, got more than that in 2002 on the second round. So I think the impact can be exaggerated. And given especially the kind of crisis we're in, and you expect parties like that to have populist right-wing nationalist parties, as we've seen elsewhere in Europe, to have quite an impact and a high vote. I mean, obviously, it's a problem. And the question of where those votes go is the battle of the next few days and week or so. But it's also the case that the left bloc candidate, Mélenchon, although he didn't do as well as expected, did pretty well, and certainly much better than the left has done for a long time in France. And so I think you're seeing what you would expect in a crisis, in a period of austerity and high unemployment, that both on the left and right of mainstream politics, you're seeing a growth of protest votes and anger at the system parties as they're seen. I mean, it's still the case, as you said, that François Hollande is probably the favourite to win in the second round. And we're then going to, if that were to happen, I think it's going to be crucial for the next period of French politics and European politics, because it's going to be about the clash with the markets and whether or not you can turn the tide of austerity politics in the mainstream of Europe. So it's very important for all of us, I think.
A great hope for Labour. If Hollande wins and at least starts to change the conversation in Europe. I mean, Europe has plunged itself into most extraordinary sort of pre-1930s state of mind, where austerity is going into a kind of death spiral, strangling country after country. And if Hollande has the power, who knows, to persuade enough countries to say, listen, Europe is here, we should be rallying around to resist the markets and to say, we'll take longer to pay off these debts. We can't possibly pay them off. It's impossible without growth. Growth must come first, growth and jobs, and that must be the priority, and then we'll deal with the debt. But because it's the only way people are going to get their money back, otherwise there will be mass defaults. You know, it's getting worse and worse, and Hollande has some of the right ideas, and I think it would be a great fillip to Labour too, to have a European ally, because the story has been Social Democrats don't win these days, and have a party that did would help Labour. Also to say, as Ed Miliband was saying in his radio interview, the idea that Social Democrats just spend money, not at all, in hard times, deciding how resources are shared is even more important, that you have Social Democrats in power for fair shares.
And Mike, what Seamus was saying there about lots of votes corralling around the edges of the political spectrum, and you're saying you might see a bit of that in the local councils, but no one's expecting it on anything like the scale we've just seen in France, where, you know, what we might call fringe parties were getting a third of the vote or so.
Well, there's no reason why we shouldn't move in their direction, become more European, as in other matters. There's no reason why the rules of the game shouldn't change here. But there is a good point, which Seamus sort of teased out, which is that there is a strong statist tradition in France, which long predates the revolution. And somebody said that in my hearing the other day, you know, the state has replaced religion in France for the last couple of years. So but on both left and right, there is easy anti-capitalist rhetoric, anti-enterprise, anti-success, French Tories would say. And that's interesting. And it's, you know, it's got echoes in this country, but much more forceful in France on, as I say, both the left and the right. Anti-Anglo-Saxon capitalist models. Okay, that's fine. We all sympathize with a lot of that. And Polly had a nice phrase there, an Hollande victory starting a conversation. Let's hope he turns out to be better in office if he wins. What's that fellow, Sarkozy? If he wins, that he turns to be better than he looks on paper. Interesting, Edna Kenny, Prime Minister of Ireland, had been an MP for 30 years in frontline politics, never been a minister, seems to be doing quite well, and the Irish austerity package is causing a lot of grief, but a lot less trouble than those in Spain, Portugal, Greece, all the usual suspects. Even the Dutch government fell this week on austerity, and even the Germans will be consumed by it in the end. It's self-defeating, but it's quite a subtle business, and, you know, if I wish I had more confidence that Hollande was the man to run with that ball and carry it back over the centre line.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. We're going to be back next Friday for a full digest of those results in Britain's local elections as they pour in, where we'll start to see if the coalition is facing the same kind of rage as other governments across the continent are, and with all the rest of the week's news in what seems to be an increasingly breathless period of politics. My thanks to Angelic Chrysophis, to Michael White, to Seamus Milne and to Polly Toynbee. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark. Thanks very much for listening.
During April, The Guardian's podcasts are partnering with audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/audible to find out more.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.